Hey, well, good evening, everybody. I'm Roger Brooks. I'm the Dean of the Faculty. I want to join the entire alumni relations staff in welcoming everyone to the 2012 reunion. It's a real pleasure for me every time we have one of these to see familiar faces from my 21 years at the college. It's even more of a pleasure for me to introduce tonight's speaker, a fellow faculty member, my friend, Professor Alex Roberto Heibel. This is the second time in a very short period of weeks that I've had the pleasure of reciting some of Professor Heibel's accomplishments. Barely 2 months ago, I introduced Alex as the 2012 recipient of the Nancy Rash Award, which is the highest award our faculty gives for scholarship and creative work. Alex stands in a line of scholars and researchers that make the faculty as distinctive as it is, faculty that create new data, analyze information in unprecedented and unexpected ways, and then enlarge the domain of knowledge within their fields. Alex Heibel is one of those who irrepressibly wants to then share that knowledge with his students. He exemplifies the scholar-teacher model that is at the very heart of Connecticut College. Reunions are always a time to recall beginnings, and so it's probably worth my noting that Alex and I began together at the college in 1991. Many is the time that we have recognized together how deeply our class, and it was the two of us plus one more, but how deeply our class has become part of the warp and woof of Connecticut College. I remember great clarity meeting Alex the very first time, wondering what he might be thinking and what was hidden behind the twinkle in his eye. He still manages to astonish me with quick wit and warm smile and a diabolical all-night exam for all of his seminar students. Well, all that to the matter at hand, introduction of Alex Heibel. Alex holds the Susan Eckert Lynch Class of 1962 professorship in the Department of Government and International Relations. A native of Argentina, Professor Heibel's courses include Democracy in Latin America, U.S. Foreign Policy Toward Latin America, The New International System. Professor Heibel is widely published, and I say that not at all lightly. He has written 6 books, including The Bush Administrations and Saddam Hussein, Deciding on Conflict, which was co-authored with Connecticut College graduate Justin Kaufman of the class of 04. Right. Professor Heibel has written countless papers, received research and teaching grants from the National Science Foundation, the Fulbright Commission, the Pew Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, and he just informed me before the evening that his newest work is under contract on U.S. foreign policymaking. It's a book of 7 chapters written with 7 different Connecticut College students. On campus, Professor Heibel is and has been a steadfast presence, having served as Associate Director for Research of the Tour Cummings Center for International Studies and Liberal Arts, CISLA, Associate Dean of the Faculty, Dean of National International Programs. He's led students on study away, teach away programs in South Africa, Cape Town, and in Seville. Recently, in 2007-08, Alex served as a visiting professor at the Hopkins Nanjing Center in Nanjing, China. Now, the beauty of Alex is that he is not just an eminent scholar, but both sides of his brain work equally well. He's also an accomplished photographer, having served as a documentarian for the U.S. Army in Vietnam. His work from travels in Spain, China, Malaysia, Thailand, and across Latin America has been seen on campus in a 2008 exhibit titled Visualizing, in presentations to our Faculty at Work lunchtime lecture series, and in 2 volumes that are for sale at the back of the room. As an amateur, very amateur photographer myself, I am in awe of the work he does. Connecticut College is a very special place because of people like Alex. I know all of you understand that. I know how deeply he cares for the institution, his students, and for the alumni. And tonight, you're going to have an opportunity to enjoy both sides of Alex's brain as he speaks about be careful of what you wish. Please welcome Professor Alex Roberto Heibel.
I hope that after Roger's introduction, you don't expect for me to walk on water. So, though sometimes I do believe I can do so too. But just a few words before we launch into the program. When I first arrived to Connecticut College, as Roger noted, in 1991, I was an ambitious professor looking forward, and I assumed that I wouldn't be staying here long. One time, my wife and I were traveling through, I don't know where, but anyway, she was driving, and I started counting the number of times that I had moved by the age of 36, and there were 26 times. And I assumed that my destiny would continue being moving into a new place. After 5 years at Connecticut College, one day I woke up and I realized that I had found my home. And I've been living in the same home for 21 years. And Connecticut College has become my home, and I have no intention of leaving unless Roger decides to fire me. I hope that's not the case. But I just wanted you to know how much this place has meant to me, and I know how much it means to you. Seeing you every year come to visit, come to share your experience with others, and visiting us. And for me, it is a great pleasure and an honor to be standing here and speaking to you. The subject that I'm covering is not my field of specialization, but it is a subject that fascinates me, largely because my field is, in some measure, I have several, but one of them is the development of democracies in developing countries. And so what I have attempted to do is to apply some of my theoretical knowledge to the study of several cases. Some can be considered in the Middle East. It is questionable whether we consider Tunisia and Libya part of the Middle East, but nevertheless, I will be discussing them. If you are not able to remember everything that I'm saying, I've written a piece on this matter, and I understand that the alumni office will place it on the web. So, because I don't like reading from what I have written, so some of the stuff that I'm going to be saying is not in what I have written, and some of the things that I have written I will not say. It just depends on my memory, and we shall see how the memory works, okay? As the revolt was ensuing last year, the New York Times, visiting Egypt, interviewed this young man by the name of Walid Rashid and asked him what he thought about it. And essentially what he suggested was that Tunisia had created the impetus for Egypt to bring about change, and that Egypt was going to be the impetus that would bring change across the world. As I read that, I said to myself, this young man doesn't know what he's talking about. And this was in January of last year. And hence, as you know well, we have a break in March, a two-week break. And I said to myself, I'm going to go there. And I went to Cairo, armed with the knowledge that I had about the difficulties, the problems, the costs that countries throughout the world had encountered as they sought to create democratic regimes. And I wanted to have a sense, a first-hand sense, of what was happening in Egypt. By that time, Hosni Mubarak had already been removed from power. So I arrived in Cairo, armed with knowledge about other parts of the world. I had taught democracy courses in South Africa, throughout Latin America, in the United States, and also in China. And I came full of doubt. I arrived in Egypt full of doubt. I spent a great deal of time walking the streets of Cairo. I was briefly nearly incarcerated for taking photographs that I was not supposed to take. And I went to Alexandria, and from Alexandria, I went to the border with Libya. Basically, at the border, I wanted to see what was happening in Libya, particularly because I knew that some refugees were moving from the Libyan territory into Egypt. And so just to remind you a little bit of your memory regarding geography fails. So here we have Egypt, Cairo is located here. I went to Alexandria, which is just northwest of Cairo, and from Alexandria I went by car to the border with Libya. And speaking with folks there, after 2 weeks I came back and I came to the realization that the hopes that the Egyptians had in my mind were unjustified. Why am I saying that they are unjustified? What I'm going to say for the next 30-40 minutes is not a hopeful presentation. I don't mean to be a cynic, but I think that I've seen quite a bit traveling and studying about democracies. And so my focus will be on 6 different countries. I shall begin with Tunisia. Tunisia, obviously, because it is there where the Spring Revolt began. And as you will notice, I will not use the word revolution. Revolution is a word misplaced. There hasn't been a revolution, neither in Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Yemen, obviously Syria, and obviously, if there has been a revolution, the only revolution that we have seen so far in the Middle East has been in Iran. And I will get there in a few moments. So the 6 countries that I will consider to repeat myself are Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Yemen, Syria, and Iran. Now, you will forgive me for a few moments, but I have to place on my head my academic fedora. And cope with me for a few moments to try to structure my argument. And I will focus on 2 broad concepts. Students who have taken my courses in democracy know very well what I'm going to be talking about. And the 2 concepts have to do with the state and the concept of sovereignty. What is it that we mean by the state? And the reason I want to emphasize the concept of the state is because in part I will argue that some of these countries that I will be discussing cannot really be considered states. And the concept of sovereignty is linked to the concept of state. Hence the 2 need to be discussed briefly. What do I mean by state, or what is it that we mean by the state? When we think about the state, we think about this large territory that is ruled by a set of institutions. But what is critical when we define the state is to recognize that the institutions that rule the state have to exist independent of other institutions within the state, and that they have to have what we normally consider a monopoly of power. That means that they are the leading institution responsible for enforcing the law, carrying the law, and passing judgment, and executing. So, what are the 3 institutions that we have in the United States? Obviously, the executive body, the judiciary body, and the legislative body. Now, when we think about this territory, this state, there is a second concept that needs to be understood, and it is the concept of sovereignty. Some 300 years ago, a Swiss scholar, don't need to remember his name, sometimes I've read it myself, it's easier to say that, you know. But essentially he was saying is that when we think about states, it is critical to be able to recognize that states exist in relationship with one another, and that each state assumes final responsibilities for the acts, for the developments, for the laws of its own state. They are the ones who carry on with the law. And no other institution outside the state has that authority, that responsibility. So think briefly for a moment. What Syria is doing today. Syria, for many of us, for all of us I assume, is carrying horrendous massacre. And the external world is trying to intervene, trying to impose on Syria, from Syria's perspective, as to what Syria ought not to do. There are two countries, two states, that are standing by Syria's freedom in reality, and the three are Russia, China, and Iran. And all three states are saying, you do not have the authority, the right, to intervene in Syria's affairs. So essentially, what these three states are emphasizing is the concept of sovereignty. Let's put that aside for a moment, and let's think about what does it take to create a state. A famous scholar from Norway, Stein Rogen, one of my very, very favorites, I read him extensively in graduate school. Essentially, he said that when you try to create a state, you have to go through four major steps. So imagine an open piece of land, and you're trying to create a state in that piece of land. The first thing that you have to do is to reach an accord with other folks within that territory. You have to coordinate things. And typically the ones who do so are the elite. And they get together and they say, well, we're going to define this piece of land as our territory. And if you study Latin America, that's basically what we did. After the Spaniards were forced out, that's basically how they went about doing it. Well, we define this boundary. Oh no, we don't agree with that boundary. People in other countries, in other territories contested that. And so they engage in this discussion. And so the very first step in the creation of a state is the coordination between elites. And let's say for the sake of argument that the coordination between elites in a very small portion of the territory reach agreement. The second step is to go to the elites in the outskirts, in the boundaries of the territory. And they start telling them, look, we're talking about creating a state. You want to be part of the state. And so you try to encompass them, bring them in. And often to achieve that end, you need the military. And one of the typical problems in the creation of the state is that initially there isn't an armed force with the competence and the authority to bring together the state. Keep that in mind, please, because when we speak about Libya, that becomes a critical issue. And from there on, you begin to bring the masses, participate in the political process, you start creating the democracy, you create political parties, and then you begin with the process of redistribution. Create tax laws that begin to address the needs of those with lesser capabilities, lesser possessions. And so, ultimately, the process of creating the state along with the democracy, you would assume you reach an end. But the question that I would like for you to think about, to ask yourself now, and this becomes very, very important, please. Think about your history. Think about what you have learned in undergraduate and graduate school about history. Ask yourself how long it took Great Britain to become a state, and how long it took Great Britain to become a democracy. If you don't remember, I'll remind you. 500 years. 300 to become a state, 200 more to become a democracy. Think about Germany, for instance. Germany is unified in the 1870s, in the 1820s, 1814, goes for a little war, then loses the war, it establishes for a brief period a democracy. And what did this democracy bring? A man by the name of Adolf Hitler. And another war ensues, and it was not until 1946 that Germany, after having been created in the 1870s as a unified state, begins to experiment with Marx. Think about France. France, the grand creator of liberty and equality along with the United States. Well, for much of the 19th century, France was an imperialist country. And it had to experiment with five different republics when it finally got it right in 1958. Just think about it. And finally think about the United States. Today, obviously, we claim the United States as being the leading force of democracy in the world. But the United States had to go through a little civil war in the 1860s, and it could not be referred as a unified state until post-1860s. And furthermore, it could not be claimed to be a democracy until 1965, with the Civil Rights Act, when folks who had been denied the freedom to participate in the political process were finally incorporated into the political process. So let's think about those. And then think about Latin American countries. Two countries. Argentina, the land of my birth. Argentina achieved its independence in 1821. It finally began to experiment with democracy after the Falkland Wars. And if you remember, that was 1982. So 100 plus years. Mexico. Well, Mexico didn't have a democracy, literally, until the year 2000. And yet it gained its independence in 1821. For 70 years, Mexico was ruled by one political party. You can do the same experiment looking at Africa. Africa today has, depending on who comes, 8 democracies. If you're really, really careful in counting democracies in Africa, out of 53 countries, there are 3 democracies. And African states achieved their independence in the 1950s and 1960s. So as you can see, the process is lengthy, it's cumbersome, it's costly, it's bloody, it's messy. Let's talk a little bit about the Middle East and some of the countries that I want to discuss here. Let's begin with Tunisia. Tunisia basically gains its independence from France in the 1950s. From the 1950s until last year, and 2 presidents. Libya. It became a sovereign state. It was given the title of a sovereign state by the United Nations in 1951. Between 1951 and last year, it had 2 rulers. One of them, a name that I'm sure many of you remember, Muammar Gaddafi, who in fact ruled a total of 41 years. Let's think about Egypt. Egypt, from 1880 until 1922, was more or less ruled by Great Britain. Britain granted independence to Egypt in 1922, but from 1922 until 1952, Britain acted as the overseer of Egypt. It didn't trust Egypt. It didn't think that Egyptians had the capacity to rule themselves. So the Egyptians had a little revolt in 1952 and established a president whom they overthrew in 1954. And in 1954, we have a man by the name of Nasser who comes to power. He is succeeded when he dies of a heart attack by Anwar Sadat, who is then assassinated by a member of the Muslim Brotherhood in 1980, and the next leader becomes Mubarak, who was dethroned last year. And by the way, I've been following carefully, trying to figure out what's the final word on Mubarak. They haven't passed judgment. Maybe they have. They don't want to release the information until tomorrow, June 2nd. Then we have Yemen. Yemen gained its independence early on in the 1920s, but from the 1920s till the present was also ruled by basically two leaders. Syria, no different. In the case of Syria, what we have is, or what we had was, once again, being granted independence in the 1950s, but then ultimately in the 1970s, a man by the name of Assad al-Assad comes to power. He dies, and when he dies, his son follows him. So what is it that these five, six countries have in common? That they came to independence very, very late, and when they gained independence, in every single case, they were ruled by autocratic regimes. But I have forgotten what. No, I haven't. I kept it for the end. Iran. What is interesting about Iran is that, as a Persian country, it was never really conquered by the Europeans, by the European colonial powers, except in 1941, when the British and the Russians decided that they didn't like the deal that Iran was trying to establish with Berlin, and hence invaded. After they left, they established their own monarchy with a parliamentary system, and in 1954, the United States, pardon me, 1953, the United States, unhappy with the Prime Minister of Iran, a man by the name of Mossadegh, who was beginning to nationalize oil. Basically, Dwight Eisenhower said to the director of the CIA, it is time for you to take action and topple him. And in 1953, the Central Intelligence Agency, under the directorship of, under the orders of Dwight Eisenhower, toppled the Mossadegh regime. The new leader, the Shah, became an ally of the United States until he was toppled. And when he was toppled, Iran experienced the first revolution in what we could refer to the Middle East. What do I mean by revolution? A revolution in which you literally have a radical transformation of the political, economic, social system. And why is it that I'm claiming that the others are not revolutionary? Because, as you will see in a minute, none of them has yet to engage in a radical transformation of its political system. Let's go back to Tunisia. What do we have in Tunisia? In Tunisia now, we have had an election that took place recently, and the two leading parties in Tunisia are the Ennahda Party, which is basically the moderate Muslim party, and a more radical party. The Ennahda Party basically has created a government with two secular political parties. What Tunisia has to decide, or is trying to decide, is obviously, as we all know, whether to remain a secular state or become an Islamic state. A student of mine, who is presently back in Tunisia, that's not mine, is it? In Tunisia, as my student says, what makes Tunisia quite different from other Middle Eastern countries is that it is a Muslim country, but not an Islamic country. And the way she explains it is very well, very easy. She says, we're all Muslims, but as Muslims, we do not necessarily believe that our religion ought to dictate every aspect of our life, which is how she goes about differentiating. But notice the following, that each one of the leaders, each one of the leaders that these six countries have hatched until the new leader in the case in 1979 in Iran. Each one of these leaders sought to create a secular state. Each one of these leaders was trying to adopt some of the values, beliefs adhered to by Western countries. They didn't want Islam to become the dictator of the state. But in doing so, they had to oppress Islamic groups, which the moment you strive to oppress a particular belief, a particular ideology, in an authoritarian fashion, that in itself provided the incentive to try to bring to power precisely those groups that had been excluded from the political process. So it ought not to be a surprise that the Ennahda Party became the winner in the case of Tunisia. What about Libya? The case of Libya is very, very different. Because Tunisia has always had a very strong connection with Europe. If you look at its territory, its location, and what it has across the Mediterranean Sea, the influence from Europe has been very, very powerful. In the case of Libya, what we have is a very different situation. And I want you to look at a little bit about the map. And one of the things that is striking about, here we have Libya, that much of the population is held around the coast. This whole region here, it's literally empty. Now, there are major oil fields around here where I have my oil. But much of the population is around the coast. Now, they have, at this very moment, a temporary government. Who are the members of this government? And this is what's generating tremendous difficulties today in Tunisia, in the department. That is, if I may, the council is set up in Tripoli. Much of the oil is in this region. Most of the representatives, over 50% of the representatives in Libya, are coming from the northwestern region. And yet, where am I? Oh, pardon me. There we go. Here, much of the oil, they are the ones who are demanding greater representation. And they're not getting that greater representation. So what is it that they're actually demanding? They're demanding the creation of a federalist system with the power for them to regulate, to make their own set of laws, to decide how to distribute their own set of earnings from the oil. That in itself is beginning to create tremendous division within Libya. So here I'm going back to the notion, do they have the means to create a state? And very, very important, under Muammar Gaddafi, he made sure that no single group ever became a dominant force. What is it that he didn't have? He didn't create a state military. So now that the war is, civil war is over, what do we have? We have multiple militias trying to gain greater and greater power. Walking into Tripoli today is no longer safe. Why? Because there are militia groups who will capture you, take you away for ransom, and therefore, the typical problem that Libya now has, before it even begins to think about creating a democracy, is that it doesn't have a state in place. It is deeply, deeply divided internally, regionally, and between the various elite from the West and the East. Let me move rapidly to the case of Egypt. What about Egypt? Egypt is a case that we've studied extensively, obviously. It's probably one of the most powerful countries in the Middle East, along with Saudi Arabia and Iran. But Egypt has been ruled for too long by the same set of leaders. And it has a military force that has become all-encompassing, all-powerful. So now we're having elections. As you know, they're preparing to have elections. The second round, what I think, it's around June 15th, June 16th. Who are the two candidates? Well, one candidate is a representative of the Muslim Brotherhood, and the other candidate is literally representative of the military regime. So in a sense, the level of dissatisfaction that you presently have in Egypt is quite extraordinary. Why? Because there's still a powerful force in Egypt who are very much afraid of creating an Islamic state. But those who are against creating an Islamic state at the same time do not want the military to return to power. So we have extraordinary intense division that is likely to explode whoever is elected. Now keep in mind the following. Parliament today is controlled by two political parties. Both political parties are basically religious parties, one more radical than the other. 70% of the parliamentary seats are controlled by these two parties. Imagine that if a president from the Muslim Brotherhood becomes president, in all probability, it will try to create an Islamic state. On the other hand, if the military leader becomes president, then you will have a horrendous clash between parliament and the military leader. What else can we add? Corruption. Corruption is endemic with these three countries that I've just mentioned. Poverty. 70% of Egypt's population lives in poverty. They barely survive with $1 or $2 a day. Unemployment amongst the young is around 25%. And the average of the median age in Egypt today is 22 years of age. Imagine that. 22. Which means that if this level of unemployment continues, you will have a horrendous explosion. Yemen. Yemen has never been a state. It is divided between the Sunnis and the Shia. The southern part of Yemen is constantly complaining against the northern part. The President Saleh, who was removed from power last year, was replaced by his vice president, who had been his vice president for 17 years and is a military leader. And what else? Al-Qaeda is deeply involved in Yemen, and so is this unit of the United States Army, Armed Forces, and the CIA. If you remember that they stopped this swap to blow a plane or something to that effect not very long ago, it was all coming from Yemen. Yemen is also highly corrupt. It has been led, as I said, for so many years by very few leaders. And Al-Qaeda is basically moving in the southern part. So we cannot be particularly hopeful. In fact, when we think about Yemen, the last thing I can guarantee you that they're thinking in Washington, D.C., is whether to create a democracy or the private. They're not going to leave the private. Syria, I think all of you know. You've been following on the news. Alan, just before we started this conversation, basically saying, what can we do in Syria? Not much. There are two, three actors who could force Al-Assad out of power. None of them is prepared to do so. Why? China, basically, because it has no interest of further enhancing the power of the United States. Russia. Russia has been a serious ally the longest. Russia has invested heavily in Syria and has provided tremendous military assistance, financial assistance, and Syria is Russia's last ally in the Middle East. So Russia is not going to sacrifice Syria automatically. And then we have Iran. What is extraordinary about this relationship is that in Iran you have primarily a Shiite population. You have more of a Sunni population in the case of Syria. But what is extraordinary is that during the Iraqi-Iran war, Syria stood by Iran. And Iran has never forgotten that. Will Al-Assad relinquish power? Only if these three countries basically remove their support. Syria's reserves have dwindled, but Iran is providing whatever it can to help, and so is Russia, and so is China, particularly making sure that they continue to receive oil. And last, let me talk a little bit about Iran. Most of you remember, I hope, 1979. The Shah is removed from power. It was the same Shah who had been installed in power by the Central Intelligence Agency in the 1950s. He is replaced by Ayatollah Khomeini. And essentially, by the end of 1979, he had succeeded, through referendum, in creating an Islamic State. Iran has a problem. Iran has a president. But neither the parliament nor the president have the power to overrule the supreme Ayatollah, who has been described as being part pope, a one-man supreme court, and the commander-in-chief, all in one person. We listen to the parliament, the Iranian parliament, we listen to the president, but in the final analysis, their voice never counts as much as the voice of the Ayatollah Khomeini. So, what can we expect?
I'm not necessarily a cynic man, but nor am I somebody who believes in miracles. Each one of these countries has endured tremendous pain, tremendous bloodshed. Each one of these countries lacks a culture that we normally associate with civil society. If you think back to the way I began, by pointing out the number of centuries that some countries had to go through to create a democracy. I ask you, please, why would you expect anything different? Why? Thank you.
Questions that you may have. I spoke in general terms without trying to get into too many specifics. As I said, I've written part of what I was saying, or more than what I said. So if you want to go into greater detail, but I didn't want to take too much time and make sure that you would have time to pose questions if you set aside. Yes, sir.
Would you comment on Turkey and Kurdistan and some of those influences?
I'm not so much of an expert, so I'd rather not. Rather than trying to just simply park the top of my head, I'd rather not. Yes, sir.
You know, when you think about the Americas, you think about Europe, we think about pluralistic societies that by and large, have democratic governance, as you described.
Right.
But that region, with almost no exception, doesn't. Is there something in the water, the air, the sunlight, that phenomenon occurs more uniquely there?
Well, no. The short answer is no. And I am both a student of politics and a student of history. And everything that I study, everything that I approach, I do it from a long-term perspective. And all I ask you is to go back to Europe, if you wish, to prior to the beginning of the 19th century. And study, go back to that history. And the misery, how we treated one another, how we destroyed one another, without getting into the specific, if you think about the role of both the Protestant and the Catholic Church. And so, in a sense, I give a tremendous amount of credit to the Renaissance, a tremendous amount of credit to Martin Luther, when he breaks away from the Catholic Church. It introduced concepts that are critical to our lifestyle, that are linked to the concept of individualism, which is a concept that is not unique to the Middle East. I mean, if we think about how we talk about a secular state, we are not denying the significance of religion. And I mean, anybody who has been following American politics today, okay? But on the one hand, the question is, to what extent will religion dictate your daily life? Not just simply your daily life, but your social, political, and economic life. And that is a critical distinction, because when we go back to Islam, to the Mohammed period, the 600s and so on, it is created not as simply a religion, but it is created as a system that encompasses every aspect, the political, social, and economic life. And so that in itself creates a culture that is deeply ingrained in you. And hence the question is, when you have a revolt, can you actually automatically disassociate yourself from it? One perfect example, if you wish, is look at Russia and the Soviet Union. And when Yeltsin removed from power Gorbachev, essentially he tried to transform Russia's political system overnight, its economic and social system, and failed miserably. Why? Basically, they didn't have a culture. A culture that takes a very, very, very long time to develop. And let me finish your question. Being from Latin America, one of the questions they always pose to me is a question related to the question you just posed. And that is, why is it that in Latin America they have been so unsuccessful at creating democratic regimes? Okay? And I come with the same answer. And that is what drove me to understand Latin America. And furthermore, keep in mind the following. That in Latin America, to save Latin America, you tell that to an Argentine, and he will be very, very mad at you. He will say, I'm not Latin American, I'm an Argentine. And for you to compare me with somebody from Bolivia, you don't know what you're talking, okay? I know it's a horrendous attitude, I recognize it, but on the other hand, well, us Argentines, we think we walk on water. Yes?
The humanitarian perspective. Well, One of the problems, for instance, if I may, I'll... The question being, from a humanitarian perspective, what is it that I witnessed? And how is that playing, what kind of a role it is playing? Let me just talk a little bit and I'll come to your question based on... Yeah, I'm just posing, nothing fancy, you know, nothing dangerous is happening. These guys were bored to death, so I figured I'll get a photograph and make myself look important, right? Okay, this is the very first demonstration that I witnessed in Cairo. And as I started photographing these gentlemen, I was immediately arrested and carried behind that wall there for a period of about 15 minutes, and I was beginning to think, okay, I'm going to be in deep trouble here. But basically, they said, we'll let you go if you just go. And I said, okay, I'll just go. I didn't want Connecticut College to be Roger Brooks trying to get me out of jail in there. And here, one of the candidates for parliament, this is not one of the presidential candidates. And basically, this is what you would see in Cairo during my visit in March. In this building, I think all of you have seen it, or if you've been reading the New York Times, it's one of the defense buildings that had been literally burned down. This is the family that hosted me. And this young woman, sitting next to the fellow. She attends the American University in Cairo, and she's a very dear friend of one of our students here who has just graduated. But it was very interesting for me to mingle with them, and particularly speaking with a gentleman. And obviously, as you can very well imagine, he was fascinated with politics. And one of the things that really struck me about what he said, and this is why I came convinced that they didn't know what was going to happen to them, he said, our military is different. Our military will really relinquish power. It is not corrupt. And I said to myself, this gentleman is hallucinating. And I would like for him and I to have a little conversation now. But this is a refugee camp. They're coming from Syria, from Libya. What is it that you see? That's waste. That's where men and women go to the bathroom, openly. Not a pleasant picture, but I think that it is one that you have to watch. This is how they slept. I was fortunate. I traveled there by van. I took my sleeping bag. I slept comfortably. This is how each one of them was sleeping every single night. This is a Northern Africa worker who had been in Libya and had left largely because of the civil war, but left with no possessions except the blankets that he had with him. That was his full possession. Early morning, washing themselves after waking up. Now, if you look the fence in the back, you notice that's where they carry on their daily bodily activities. More of the same. And mind you, the temperature at night would drop around to 40. And so I was inside my sleeping bag, a van, very, very comfortable altogether. And this demonstrations in Cairo, the main square. But notice here what is quite fascinating. That this is one of the gravest concerns that folks in Egypt have. That here you have two women with completely different outfits, attires, standing next to one another. And whatever you want to say about the Mubarak regime, whatever you want to say, the emphasis was not on religion. Now, I'm not going to suggest that women had extraordinary rights, but this is one of the great fears, speaking to us, to the woman with the hat, that that was her great fear. To what extent, if Egypt were to create an Islamic Republic, to what extent would she be allowed to continue participating in the political process? Notice what it says here. It's a very interesting line that really captured my attention. The bottom line, we will not be ruled by the United States or European Union anymore. Notice what it says, anymore. In spite of our sincere love for their people. Now that is an issue that clearly, going back to your point, particularly the role of NGOs, to what extent will they be trusted in the future? Now NGOs for the time being are the ones, or until recently, the institutions, the organizations that could address some of the basic needs, particularly when we are thinking about the simple fact that the state could not address their own problems. So when you're thinking about what is bound to ensue, the question obviously is, will they be allowed to stay any longer? Can they continue working? If you're going to have the question of sovereignty related to this point here, that immediately comes to the fore. That is, what is an NGO? A non-governmental organization. Is that the case? Is that how they view it? Okay, you're shaking your head. You're right. That's not how they view it. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
We talked a lot about very interesting history tonight. You had the opportunity to advise President Obama at this time.
I think Mr. Obama has his hands full. I mean, I get very, very upset. And here I'm not siding with the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. But I get very, very terribly upset when you have somebody like John McCain and Mitt Romney saying that the United States is not doing enough. Well, we did a lot in Iraq. For what end? For what end? We're now in Afghanistan, and finally it dawned on them that if they wanted to create a state, and this goes to my original argument, if they wanted to recreate, restructure the state in Afghanistan, it would take a good 70 to 100 years. And one of the things that we have learned is that you cannot create a state when such state does not exist. And when the citizens of that state or that territory have no desire to have foreigners intervening in their affairs. So, just a moment, please. This is for alumni primarily, so I'm addressing the alumni question. So when we are thinking about the state of Afghanistan, what is it that the President of the United States and all of his assistants have acknowledged? That the leader of Afghanistan is a deeply corrupt individual. That the system is corrupt. So how do you create a state? How do you bring about democracy in a territory that is led by corrupt people? And corruption is, I hate to say this, but the common denominator that emerges whenever there is a revolt, whenever there is an attempt to bring about a critical, radical transformation, what is the best example that we have presently? Just look at Russia. Horrendous rules.
ask yourself, who are the principal beneficiary parties? And so, in a sense, what I was trying to propose is that when I said I'm not a cynic, but nor do I believe in miracles, what I'm trying to also suggest is that they need not give up hope, but they have to be cognizant that the process is slow, it is costly, it is destructive, and much blood will be shed during this, the future years to come. I apologize for not providing you a rosy picture, but it is not a rosy future. But that doesn't mean that it ought to end in despair. So, oh, what?
Colonialism.
Okay. Colonialism obviously had a tremendous impact. There's no question. But at some point, and I have to acknowledge this, that my colleagues at this institution and I are bound to disagree on this matter. At some point, you need to stop giving excuses. And yes, colonialism a horrendous impact. It destroyed the capacity of these states to develop their own institutions. And one of the leftovers of colonialism is that when they left them without any type of institutions. I remember one of my favorite arguments was presented some 180 years ago by Simón Bolívar, maybe not that long ago, but about 170 or so. Simón Bolívar, the so-called liberator of Latin America, and his grandest criticism of the Spaniards was that when the Spaniards left, they hadn't taught them how to govern themselves. And thus, it took them a good 100 plus years for them to start learning how to do it amongst themselves without killing themselves in the process. Yes, ma'am?
But it's not true of all the colonies. The people in
England is the great example. I have to agree with you. Your point is very, very well taken. You're quite correct on that.
Couldn't hear the
question. I beg your pardon?
The
question is that that wasn't the case in all of them. And perfect example, for instance, if you wish to think about it, is the case of the United States. I mean, in the United States, it was a colony. I'm not entirely convinced about India. And the reason I would say, for me, India is not a democracy to begin with. I don't mean to offend anybody, it's far from being a democracy. I mean, when you have such a substantial minority being really treated as the unwanted, that is not a democracy. So, and it remains still in many ways a chaotic place where the levels of economic inequality and ethnic inequality is substantial. So, in a sense, what Britain left was an example that was not particularly well developed further by Indians. Sorry. Any other questions? Yes, please. And can you speak a little louder, please?
I can.
Why don't you stand up? I can hear you better. I like to forgive her a bad time. You know.
Excuse my eyes, okay. But in your professional opinion, what's the best thing
Well, I think the first thing that they need to do is actually persuade Russia, and I would hope Iran, which is a very difficult task in by itself, and China. If Russia, China, and Iran were, or at least Russia and China, were to say, we've given up on you, I think that we would see Assad packing his bags right away. But with that said, Syria is going to come to the same problems that the other countries are encountering. Because Syria is a deeply, deeply divided country. It's deeply corrupt. And you're going to have a major... It's one of those countries in which you still have a substantial divide between Shiites and Sunnis. Not as substantial as in other places, like, for instance, as Yemen. But I would venture to argue that in the case of Syria, you're going to have tremendous discord for an extended period still, even if Assad were to pull out. And remember the following, that there is a transitional government that exists outside Syria, and there's tremendous division within that transitional government. And basically, the leader of that transitional government is being asked to resign, and yet they do not know who to put in to replace him, and they think of putting a Christian, and Muslims are very much opposed to the idea of having a Christian. And then you have a situation between Syria and Lebanon. So.
And on that note, let's have one last question. How do you read the future as far as Iran is concerned?
Okay. Well, the debate, obviously, that we have, first of all, let me begin with a very simple recognition that Ayatollah Khomeini and the Islamic Republic is not going to go away. That's not going to go away. I mean, there is a major force in Washington, D.C. to try to transform Iran's government. That transformation, if it comes to the point that they try to actually transform, you're going to see bloodshed. Number one. Number two, the question obviously is related to Israel. And that, well, Israel, to the extent, let me put it this way, will Iran relinquish its commitment to enriching uranium? The fear, obviously, is to reach uranium to the 20% and to continue above that to develop a nuclear weapon. And this comes to the question of sovereignty. And I'm not going to suggest that I'm able to put myself in the minds of the Iranian leaders. But from a theoretical sovereignty perspective, my argument would be very, very, very simple. I said, you all have one. Why shouldn't I? I mean, I think it's a bit hypocritical if you think about it carefully, if you distance yourself who we are and the country we belong to. China has nuclear bombs, Russia has, India has, Pakistan has, Britain has, France has, and so do we. So sovereignty on the part of the Iranians is a critical issue. Now obviously Israel is not too keen. And for the Israelis, if they develop a nuclear weapon, the question of sovereignty goes down the drain rapidly. So I think that the next year, what we're going to witness in the next year, could be very interesting. Now, it is proven to be very, very costly for the Iranians to continue the path of trying to enrich uranium, to promote their own sovereignty. Very, very costly. Why? Because of the steps taken by Western countries. But Iran still has support from China. And China has not given up on Iran. And it's not in China's interest. Nor has Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. You know, interestingly, if you study now Latin America, the greatest investor today in Latin America is no longer the United States. It's the People's Republic of China. And Iran is attaching itself to the hip of China and moving also rapidly. Throughout the Caribbean, the investments of the Chinese throughout the Caribbean is quite, quite extraordinary. And that is an area the United States doesn't want to be caught asleep at the wheel, that it ought to pay some attention.
I remind you that I told you Professor Heibel likes to have all night long exams. If you keep asking questions, he will keep them. But let's thank him very much. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you very much.